Okay, minor prophets. Here we are. Here we are again. Deja vu. Yeah. But it's going to be good. If you have your paper and you have not turned it in, now would be the time to turn in those papers. I'm very excited to read them. So I will have to read them at lightning pace to get them all graded in time for cool things. But I enjoy reading the papers because it's interesting. Okay, let's jump in to our next prophet. We're going to start with Habakkuk. Habakkuk is probably my favorite minor prophet. We don't spend a lot of time dealing with him because it's pretty straightforward, but the character that Habakkuk displays is it's interesting and admirable in many ways, and just someone I enjoy reading through how he handles things. So let's look at the author as we talk about Habakkuk. While some traditions exist concerning Habakkuk, there's some like Jewish traditions about who he was. Biblical revelation actually contains little about the prophet. That's not surprising. It's true for most of the minor prophets. In fact, it identifies him simply as the prophet. That's all you get. Not a fig farmer. Not a shepherd or anything like that. He's just the prophet. The prophecy itself gives scant information about who he is. Habakkuk is a prophet, and based on his conversation with the Lord, he must have lived before the Babylonian exile. The prophecy does contain some musical notations, leading some to theorize that Habakkuk may have been a musician, because he talked about music stuff. So some people feel like, hey, that's a pretty good way to go for maybe who he was. Challenge to that is that I also can speak with musical things. Like I can talk about stuff musically. I have extremely little musical experience. And no one in this world would ever qualify me as a musician. Like would say, Nathan, the musician. No, that guy is a liar. That doesn't mean I can't use those terms though if I wanted to. So, does it mean he's a musician? No, it doesn't. But maybe it at least tells us he's familiar with music. So there's that. Maybe he is a musician. That would be fine with me. In terms of setting, Habakkuk ministered during the decline of the kingdom of Judah. In 609 BC, King Josiah died and was succeeded by King Jehoiakim. The moral and economic fall was fairly sharp at this point in history. And it would culminate in 587 when Babylon finally conquers Jerusalem for the last time. Babylon's conquering of Jerusalem, they did it several times, of course. But in 587, they just completely, they're done messing with it, and they conquer it totally. During the time of Habakkuk's prophecy, Babylon was a growing world power. They have conquered, along with the Medes, they conquered Nineveh in 612. That's what was predicted by Nahum. So in 612, Babylon conquers Nineveh, and then Babylon is on top. And Babylon begins conquering everything else. For theme, the primary theme of Habakkuk is the justice of God. And at the core of this theme, however, is a question of the long-suffering nature of God. So God is just, but he is also long-suffering. How do those things mix together? That is, Habakkuk is concerned with the manner in which God executes his justice. Have you ever wanted God to be just? I was driving once, a number of years ago. I was going to see my fiance, and was actually going to go get married to my fiance, which was successful, by the way. So you know where the story is going, but I was driving through Colorado, which is fine. I grew up in Colorado, and I knew how to drive in Colorado. It turns out Coloradans drive different than most people. And that's, you know, it's okay. We like to get places. We don't like to spend our time driving. So we tend to go to higher velocity. But I was, I just completed my freshman year here at Frontier, and I was growing as an individual. And I'd come under, over the course of the year, some very heavy conviction regarding how I was driving. And so I was driving across Colorado to go to Utah, where my bride was at. And on the highway, there's a section of the road in the mountains that the speed drops down from, like, I mean, for a while you're doing, for a lot of the portion up to that, you're doing 75, and the speed drops down to 50 miles an hour as you go through this little canyon. It's only a few miles long, but it's the most annoying few miles in that whole trip. Like, agonizingly slow if you go 50 miles an hour. And so, because you're in Colorado, no one goes 50 miles an hour. It's just the nature of it. You know, you could get stopped, and, you know, the police would patrol it periodically, but you just play an odds game, and that's the way it was. So I hit the section of freeway and came under, as I said, I was under a lot of growing conviction in terms of my driving, so I slowed down to the speed limit and maintained the speed limit. Up to that point, I'd been having a great day driving, and it continued to be great afterwards, but I slowed back down. I slowed down when I came into this section. And I had only been in the section for a little while, and then a car, I mean, flies by me. And just roaring maybe 80 miles an hour. And I was in my car all by myself and with God. And I was talking with God, and I said, God, that's not right. Where's the justice here? I am doing the right thing. There should be justice. And I said to that car, this is how bored I was in the car. I'm actually talking to cars. I didn't even talk to the driver. I was just talking to the car. And I said, I will see you again because this section of road is going to end and I will be able to get back up to speed. I will see you again on the other side. I did see this car again about an hour later. They had been pulled over. There was justice. It just didn't come when I wanted it. Now, there have been a lot of other times in my life that I've wanted justice, but realized if God were just in this situation, I would be one of the first ones condemned. All problems. Habakkuk is dealing with all of these problems as he goes into the passage. So let's look at Habakkuk. Habakkuk chapter 1, the oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. Now, I want to point out here that Habakkuk identifies himself as a prophet. He also uses the term saw, which is, we looked at way back at the beginning of the semester, but he's clearly using it metaphorically to describe the prophecy that he has. Because what he's about to relay is not a vision. It's a conversation that he has with God. And so it's not something he's seeing in particular. So it's metaphorical. It's just, this is what I want to share with you that God has revealed to me. And so this is what I saw. So what does he see? We get a question and answer. This is part of why I like Habakkuk. He's a bold kind of guy. And he's willing to go to God with his questions. He's reverent. He treats God with respect, but when he has a question, he asks God his question. So he goes to God with his question. Let's look at verse 2. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. Justice is not happening. His question is an initial question, relatively straightforward. Why is God permitting the evil that he sees around him? He's in Jerusalem and he's looking out and he's looking at all the people and he goes, evil, evil, evil. I'm seeing all this evil stuff. God, why aren't you doing something? Why aren't you just? The Israelites are breaking the law, but they seem to go unpunished. And so that's Habakkuk's question. I know you're a just and righteous God, but why am I seeing all this evil take place? Why aren't you acting right now? So God gives him an answer in verse 5. God begins his response, and his answer is basically this. Just wait. Justice will come soon. In fact, he says it will be in your days. That's in the middle of verse 5. I'm doing a work in your days. So justice is going to take place. That's God's answer. Habakkuk says, why aren't you exercising justice now? And his response is, just wait. I am going to be just. I'm working this justice out. It's going to happen. In verses 6 through 11, God talks about the justice that is coming. And that justice is going to come through the Babylonians or the Chaldeans. God, speaking to Habakkuk, describes how fierce they are, their ability at war and violence. This will be the justice that Israel has. So Habakkuk has a question. I see all this evil and you're not acting. Why aren't you acting out with justice right now? And God has an answer. He says, Habakkuk, I will be just. I'm working something out right now. I'm going to bring the Babylonians in and they're going to execute my justice on the people of Israel. So we come to Habakkuk's second question, which is even better than the first. Let's look at verse 13. Or let's start at verse 12. So Habakkuk's second question. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. I mean, I know you are a faithful God and you have preserved Israel, so we shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment and you, a rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? Okay, there's a shift here because he says you can't look it upon evil. We talked about that, I think, in theology class. That doesn't mean that God doesn't see evil. He's aware of it. In fact, at the beginning of the book, in verse 3, Habakkuk says, you idly look at wrong. So he recognizes that God sees evil. But his first complaint, he says, God, you see the evil and you're not reacting to it. In the second complaint, second question, Habakkuk says, okay, so your solution is to cause, like now, but you're so holy, how could you do this? Now that you're saying you're going to bring these Chaldeans against us. Verse 13, God is holy. How can he use those which seem to do such evil in the world? How could you use the Babylonians? Because you're a holy God. Habakkuk questions God's actions in light of his character. Note that the first portion is often quoted. People will talk about the fact that God cannot look at wrong, but not the whole, which goes on to say, you know, you're looking idly at traitors and things like that. The idea is that God cannot approve evil, not that he cannot actually view it. He can see evil. But Habakkuk says, you can't approve of that because that's evil. So how can you make use of that? To strengthen his case, Habakkuk describes the despicable nature of the Babylonians. They perpetrate evil and they give credit to their skill and to their gods. So this is what's going on. Habakkuk has a question when he starts. He says, God, why aren't you just? I see all this evil taking place and you're not acting out against that evil. So I know you're just in character, but why aren't you executing justice? God responds and says, it's okay, Habakkuk, I'm going to execute my justice. I'm going to bring the Babylonians. And then Habakkuk comes back and says, whoa! I mean, in Hebrew. You can't do that because the Babylonians are evil, evil people. How could you bring those evil people against us? We're your holy ones. We're your, we're the Israelites. How could you do that? Do you see the problem Habakkuk has? You know, God, I want you to be just. But then God says, okay, I'll be just. And Habakkuk is like, what? You can't do that. Like, I have a problem now with that justice. Because you seem to be using this evil. And so he says, these are really, really evil people, Lord. Maybe you don't realize how evil they are. And so he reminds them how evil they are. And he says, so how can you use them? How could you use these people? And then chapter 2, Habakkuk anticipates his own error. He knows the issue when you're talking with God is never God. Like if there's a problem, it's on me. I'm misunderstanding something or whatever. So he goes through the whole thing. He's very bold, Habakkuk. He doesn't hide his emotions. He doesn't try to cover things up. He just says, God, how could you do this? Because these are really evil people. And then he says in chapter 2, I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what you will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. He's anticipating I'm wrong somewhere. God is going to show me where I'm wrong. So I'm going to wait for the answer and I'm going to find out where am I wrong so that I can correct those things. And then God answers, and that's the rest of chapter 2. God answers Habakkuk by explaining that the Babylonians will also be judged. You're right, they're evil too. Now, as God, God has the prerogative to use them, regardless of whether or not they're evil. God does not only have to use holy things to accomplish his purposes. He can use the evil things too. He's God, so he's sovereign. He has the authority, the right, the privilege to do it. But he also recognizes that they are evil. They will also be judged. He may use them, but they are still responsible for their actions. And they will face his ultimate justice, just as do the Israelites. Now, it could have been different. Because God could have used the Babylonians. They could have done it and said, God, we will come and conquer the Israelites, but we will give glory to you in the midst of this. And we're only going to attack them when you say so. And we're only going to, treat them the way you want us to treat them. So they could have done it in a godly way, and they don't. And because they don't, they will be judged. No, I don't know that I don't have any idea that they did. But as people, they could have come and recognized the true and living God. But we refuse to do that. And so they're going to face judgment for that. And so his response to Habakkuk is significant. It's long, but his response is basically like, Habakkuk, slow your roll. Right? I'm gonna be just. I'm gonna be just against the Israelites because I'm gonna use the Babylonians. And then when Habakkuk says, how can you do that? Because they're evil. God says, look, I can use them too. I'm God. I'm sovereign. I'm gonna use them. They're not going to do things in a righteous way, in a right way, and so I will also judge them. Everyone is under my judgment because I'm God. So I'm the one who makes all those determinations. The book ends with a praise to God in chapter 3. And if you look at chapter 3, this is where you get some of the musical notations. This actually becomes kind of like a psalm of sorts. The prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to the Shigianoth. What we read in this praise in the first portion, Habakkuk describes the awesomeness of God and the response that comes from knowing his presence. He brings justice, and in doing so, he brings salvation to his people. That's a comfort to Israel. I mean, you're going to face judgment, and it's going to be terrible, but God is also going to deliver. God will keep his promises. So there is comfort in the midst of that. The book ends in this understanding, having understood that God is just and gracious. Habakkuk proclaims that God is always rightly praised. Regardless of the grimness of the situation, praise should go to God because God is just. We don't always experience justice the way we want to experience justice, but God is always just. And that's what Habakkuk learns. All right, any questions about Habakkuk before we move on? It's good. I really like Habakkuk. It's kind of it's a powerful book. Zephaniah is easily in my top 12 for minor prophets. No, I actually like Zephaniah too. It's a little bit different, but I enjoy reading it. So some background about Zephaniah from the introduction. Zephaniah seems to be a descendant of King Hezekiah. This is certainly a demonstration that God called people from all positions to prophesy. Zephaniah is presumably in Jerusalem, which is sensible given his family history. Positions. Sorry. So Hezekiah was his great-great-grandfather, but still. That puts Zephaniah in the royal line. It's something to keep in mind when you read his prophecy, because he has some things to say about the leaders. That would be unflattering, but he's one of them. He's one of the nobles, so it's personal. The setting, by date, Zephaniah would have ministered before Habakkuk during the reign of Josiah. During this time, Judah was, generally speaking, not doing well in its relationship with the Lord. However, Josiah did introduce some reforms which brought Judah back to the Lord for a time. The text does not reveal if it was written before or after the reform. It's just for us to know the reforms happened. There was generally peace during this time. So it's generally peace in a civil situation. And while things were not great, they weren't as bad as they could be. Themes. In many ways, Zephaniah is a counterpart to Joel. The main theme of Zephaniah is also the day of the Lord, as it was in Joel. But now we're on like the opposite end of, the minor prophets, we're getting to the end of that, but we're on the opposite end of the kingdom era. Joel, as we talked about with dating, I think was much earlier, and Zephaniah is coming into the end. He's maybe 30 years out from when Jerusalem was captured. So it's a counterpoint to Joel. The day of the Lord, of course, is the time of judgment. And Zephaniah is recognizing that that judgment is necessary for Judah. The book is an anticipation of the culmination of God's plans. So let's dig into Zephaniah. Verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Zephaniah, son of Cushi, son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, the son of Amon, king of Judah. So he identifies himself. Zephaniah gives both his pedigree and the dates of his prophecy by pointing out all these kings. So the first thing with the son of, that's his pedigree. I am someone. I'm in the royal line. And then he dates it to Josiah. So pedigree and date. And then he explains that what he's about to share is the word of the Lord. What does the Lord have to say? Verse 2. I will utterly sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. Boom. Like, that's a way to start a prophecy. Then if it was unclear, we get verse 3. So I will utterly sweep away everything. Verse 3. I will sweep away man and beast. I will sweep away the birds of the heaven and the fish of the sea and the rubble with the wicked. I will cut off mankind from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I'm going to sweep it all away. It'll reach a point when it is done. And I will bring that judgment. So we have the judgment of the world there, which we just talked about. Okay, verses 4 through 18 of chapter 1, the day of judgment for Judah. Verses 4 through 9, judgment is coming because of idolatrous worship, but ironically, the Lord has prepared a sacrifice. And that sacrifice is Judah. Note that Zephaniah calls out the royalty in this section. Verse 8. I will punish the officials and the king's sons and all who array themselves in foreign attire. So that's a pretty rough thing to say when you are part of the royal family, right? Verses 14 through 16, Zephaniah describes the horror of the day of the Lord. Judah will be punished. Jerusalem will be laid waste. The Israelites will be punished for their wickedness. And so he goes through and he details some of those things. Verses 17 through 18 connects this punishment with the punishment of the world in verses 2 to 3. So let's read 17-18. I will bring distress on mankind so that they shall walk like the blind because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be poured out like the dust and their flesh like dung. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them on the day of the wrath of the Lord. In the fire of his jealousy, all the earth shall be consumed. For full and sudden end, he will make all the inhabitants of the earth. So, verses 2 and 3, he starts off, he says, I'm going to wipe away everything. I'm going to sweep it all away. And then he talks about the judgment of Judah, judgment of Judah, judgment of Judah. And when he's tying up that judgment on Judah, he connects it to, remember, I'm going to get rid of all this stuff. So I'm going to sweep it all away. Judah's a part of that process. Judah's a part of what's going to happen. So it forms an inclusio where he's talking about that judgment. All right, chapter 2 through a portion of 3, we get the day of judgment detailed. In chapter 2, God gives special consideration to the enemies of Judah. In this day of the Lord, they will know the wrath and judgment of the Lord. They will not be spared. So, chapter 1 really focuses on Judah. Chapter 2, we begin to look at, what about everyone else? They're also going to go through this judgment. If God is sweeping everything off the earth, that includes not just Judah, it also includes the people of the other nations. And then when he gets into chapter 3, God gives, while he's giving attention to Judah's enemies, Judah itself will not escape his punishment. So he goes back and he visits what will take place with Judah. So Judah will not escape. The reason is clear. Despite God's faithfulness, the leaders lead in rebellion and corruption. Judah will be caught up with the world. So as God is bringing judgment on the whole world, Judah is going to be in the mix. In the last portion of chapter 3, we get a shift, starting at verse 9. Verse 9, for at that time I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech, that all of them may call upon the name of the Lord and serve him with one accord. There's a shift here, and we get a day of restoration. Through the day of the Lord, God will bring restoration not only to Israel, but also to the world. There will be unity, particularly in the worship of the Lord. So everyone's speech will be purified so they can worship the Lord well. They will do this, he says, with one accord. So there's unity now in what's taking place. Verses 11 through 13, God will purify the nation of Israel. The humble who have held to God remain and are lifted by his grace, while the evil are purged. Zephaniah offers a praise at the end, a praise to the Lord for his ultimate redemption of Israel. This praise includes some of the blessing which the Israelites can expect, which is safety, renown, gathering, and the love of God, all things that we have seen before through the other prophets. But let's look at verse 17 in particular. The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you by his love. He will exult over you with loud singing. That is going to be a day when we get to hear the Lord God sing over his people. And a real sign of his love. Both my kids, when they were very tiny, I used to make up songs. Have I told you guys about songs I used to make up? Okay.
I feel like they were absolutely cool.
They were phenomenal. I do not have any musical skill, but I do have rhyming skill. So I would make up, and meter. I'm really good with the meter. So I would make up songs all the time for everything. I had a car seat song, which got outlawed by my wife. I told her it's not my fault that dead and head rhyme. But, yeah, she thought it was a little grisly to be singing to my daughter. Emery at the time was like this big, right? So she's a tiny little baby, and I was, the car seat. You gotta protect your head. Don't want you dead. All sorts of things about the car seat. So I had a car seat song, but for both of my kids, I have a little song that I have sung about them since they were like itty bitty, and I don't sing it as much now because, it's just not always appropriate. Little kids you can sing to, but if I started singing to my teenage son in the lunch line, he's not going to be happy, and. I think everyone else would find it more humorous than understanding, but it's my love to them. Hey, I love you guys. This is like my special way of communicating I love you in a deep and kind of special way. Here is God dealing with Israel, and he gets to the point where the end of all the things, Zephaniah is so clearly looking at the tribulation. God is going to deal with the whole world. And he's going to bring it all under judgment, and Israel is going to be a part of that, but Israel is going to find redemption. And God is even going through the process to bring out some of the nations in redemption. And when he does that, he gets Israel into the land, he gathers Israel up, he gives Israel all the things that Israel has been waiting for thousands of years. And he says, he, the Lord God, will sing over them. It's a beautiful picture and a wonder, especially given all the judgment earlier in the book that Zephaniah goes through. But he ends with that kind of promise. And so this brings us back to that understanding of the day of the Lord being not just anticipating the tribulation, but also the kingdom era. That culmination of God's plans all falls under that day. Okay, we are going to be a little early out today, which is totally fine. Redemption. Oh, did I not? Redemption. It's right there. So after you write the word redemption, you're free to go. Enjoy your extra 10 minutes. The test in here will be on Monday.